business schools who'd be glad. What do you know about Harvard and Penn? Mr. Kinderdine told us they were the best in the country, in business. Hawksworth stiffened and growled. I suppose your Mr. Kinderdine said that anyone who bothered to go into business... Oh, no. He thinks business is the modern ocean for contemporary Francis Drakes and Jean Lafitte's. Weren't they pirates? Hawksworth asked suspiciously. They were adventurers. Mr. Kinderdine told Whip Janders he ought to try like the devil to get into Harvard Business School. But he didn't tell you that, did he? No, Dad. He thinks I can write. There was a long pause in the big room as the pastel lights of morning spread across the city below. And one of those rare moments developed in which a son can talk to his father. And if Hawksworth Hale had growled in his customary manner, the moment would have passed, like the ghost of Pele ignoring one whom she considered not worth a warning. But Hawksworth's personal god sat heavily on his shoulder, and he said nothing, so that his son continued. You and your father, and all your generations, used to sit up here, Dad, and look down at Honolulu, and dream of controlling it. Every streetcar that ran, every boat that came to port, did so at your command. I appreciate that. It's a noble drive, a civilizing one. Sometimes I've caught a glimpse of such a life for myself. But it's always past, Dad. I just don't have that vision. And you've got to find someone who has, or you and I will both go broke. Don't you have any vision at all? Hawksworth asked quietly, back in the shadows. Oh, yes. The handsome young fellow pointed to Honolulu, lying tribute beneath them, and confided for the first time to anyone. I want to control this city too, Dad. But I want to bore into its heart to see what makes it run. Why the Chinese buy land and the Japanese don't. Why the old families like ours intermarry and intermarry until damn near half of them have somebody locked away in upstairs rooms. I want to know who really owns the waterfront, and what indignities a man must suffer before he can become an admiral at Pearl Harbor. And when I know all these things, I'm going to write a book, maybe lots of them, and they won't be books like the ones you read. They'll be like The Grandmothers and Without My Cloak, books you never heard of. And when I know, and when I have written what I know, then I'll control Honolulu in a manner you never dreamed of, because I'll control its imagination. He was slightly drunk and fell back in his chair. His father watched him for some minutes, during which fragments of The Grandmothers repeated themselves in Hawksworth's agitated mind. Finally, the father said, I suppose you don't want to bundle off to the cram school. No, Dad. What will you do? There's no sweat getting into either Cornell or Alabama. I'll register Monday at McKinley High. Hawksworth winced and asked, Why McKinley? The kids call it Manila Prep, and I'd sort of like to know some Filipinos. You already know. Doesn't Consul Adujo's son go to Punahou? I want to know real Filipinos, Dad. Hawksworth Hale started to rear back, as if he were about to tell his son that he would tolerate no nonsense about McKinley High School. But as words began to formulate, he saw his son etched against the pale morning light. And the silhouette was not of Bromley Hawksworth, the radical essayist who had outraged Hawaii, but of Hawksworth Hale, the radical art critic who had charged Yale University with thievery. And a bond of identity was established, and the father swallowed his words of reprimand. Tell me one thing, Bromley. This Mr. Kinderdine, can his ideas be trusted? The best, Dad. Unemotional, yet loaded with fire. You heard, I suppose, that we're losing him, joining the Navy. Says there's bound to be war. There was a painful silence, and the boy concluded, Maybe that's why I want to go to McKinley now, Dad. There mayn't be too much time. He started to bed, but realized that he owed his father some kind of apology, for the mimeographed essay had created a storm which he, the author, had not anticipated. About that photograph of you, Dad, what I mean is, if I do become a writer, I'll be a good one. And he stumbled off to bed. In 1941, the Thanksgiving Day football game was largely a replay of the 1938 Classic, with Punahou pitted against McKinley. But this time, two Sakugawa boys played for Punahou, for Hawksworth Hale and his committee of alumni had been so pleased with Tadao's performance that they had automatically extended scholarships to the younger boys, Minoru, the tackle, and Shigeo, the halfback. Thus it was that the former privy cleaner, Kamijiro, sat in the stadium along with his wife and his two older boys. Goro was in army uniform, cheering for Punahou. A newspaper man remarked, "It's a revolution in Hawaii when Sakugawa the barber and Hawksworth Hale support the same team." Throughout Hawaii, these minor miracles of accommodation were taking place. When a child felt pain, he said, "Itai, itai," which was Japanese. When he finished work, it was pahana. He had aloha for his friends. He tried to avoid pilikia. And when he flattered girls, it was huumalimali, all Hawaiian words. He rarely ate candy, but kept his pockets filled with seed, a delicious Chinese confection, tasting like licorice, sugar, and salt all at once, and made of dried cherries or plums. After a dance, he did not eat hot dogs. He ate a bowl of saimin, Japanese noodles, with teriyaki barbecue. Or he had chop suey. For dessert, he had a Portuguese malasada, a sweet, sticky, fried donut, crackling with sugar. It was an island community, and it had absorbed the best from many cultures. On this day, as Punahou battled McKinley in a game that was more thrilling to Honolulu than the Rose Bowl game was to California, Punahou, the Haole Heaven, fielded a team containing two Sakugawas, a Key, two Kalanianoles, a Rodriguez, and assorted Hales, Hewletts, Janderses, and Hawksworths. That year, Punahou won 27-6, and Shigeo Sakugawa scored two of the touchdowns, so that as he went home through the streets of Kaka'ako, the perpetual toughs taunted him contemptuously with being a haole lover, but they no longer tried to assault the Sakugawa boys. They knew better. Logically, the Sakugawas should have been able, what with the aid of scholarships for three of the boys, to retire Riko-chan from the barbershop, allowing her to enroll in the university. But just as the family had enough money saved ahead for this, the consulate on Uwanu Street convened the Japanese community and told them gravely, "The war in China grows more costly than ever. We have got to assist our homeland now. Please, please remember your vows to the emperor." And the fund had gone to help Japan resist the evil of China's aggression. Though Goro asked his friends, "How can China be the aggressor when it's Japan that's done the invading?" He wanted to ask his father about this, but Kamijiro, in these trying days of late 1941, had pressing problems which he could not share with his children, nor with anyone else for that matter, except Mr. Ishii. They began when Hawaii established a committee of American citizens whose job it was to visit all Japanese homes, beseeching the parents to write to Japan to have the names of their children removed from village registers, thus canceling their Japanese citizenship. Hawksworth Hale was the committee member who visited the Sakugawas, and with Reiko as interpreter, he explained on the day after Thanksgiving, "Mr. Sakugawa, Japan is a nation that insists upon dual citizenship, but since your five fine children were born here, legally they're Americans. Emotionally, they're Americans too. But because you registered their names in your Hiroshima village years ago, they are also Japanese citizens. Suppose the war in Europe spreads. What if Japan and America get into it on opposite sides? Your sons might face serious difficulties if you allow them to retain two citizenships. To protect them, get it cleaned up." The five children added their pleas. "Look, Pop," they argued, "we respect Japan, but we're going to be Americans." Their father agreed with them. He nodded. He told Mr. Hale that it ought to be done, but as always before, he refused to sign any papers. This the children could not understand, and they sided with Mr. Hale when he said, "It really isn't right, Mr. Sakagawa, for you to penalize your sons, especially with three of them being Punahou boys." But Sakagawa-san was adamant, and after Mr. Hale had left and his family began hammering him with their arguments, he felt caged and finally kicked a chair and shouted, "I'm going away where a man can get some peace." He sought out Mr. Ishii and sat glumly with him. "Our evil has caught up with us, old friend," he said. "It was bound to, sooner or later," Mr. Ishii reflected sadly. "The children are insisting that I write to Hiroshima and take their names off the village registry." "You aren't going to do it, are you?" Mr. Ishii asked hopefully. "How can I, and bring disgrace upon us all?" The two men, now gray in their late 50s, sat moodily and thought of the shame in which they were involved. In their village, Kamajiro had been legally married by proxy to the pretty girl Sumiko, by whom he had had five children, all duly reported. And Mr. Ishii had been legally married to Mori Yoriko, no children reported. Yet by convenient switching, Kamajiro had married Yoriko American style, and she was the mother of the children. Mr. Ishii had likewise married Sumiko, and she had turned out to be a prostitute. How could they explain these things to the Japanese consulate on Nuuanu Street? How could they explain this accidental bigamy to the five children? Above all, how could they explain it to the village authorities in Hiroshima? "All Japan would be ashamed," Mr. Ishii said gloomily. "Kamajiro, we better leave things just as they are." "But the children are fighting with me. Today even Mr. Hale came to the house. He had the papers in his hands." "Of course he had the papers," Mr. Ishii agreed. "But you watch his face when you try to explain who your wife is. Kamajiro, friend, let the matter drop." But on Saturday, December 6th, Mr. Hale returned to the shack and said, "You are the last holdout on my list, Mr. Sakagawa. Please end your son's dual citizenship. With Goro here in the army, and Tadao and Minoru in the ROTC, it's something you've got to do." "I can't," Kamajiro said through his interpreter, Goro, who had a weekend pass from Schofield Barracks. "I don't understand the old man," Goro said, smoothing out his army uniform, of which he was obviously proud. "He's loyal to Japan, but he's no great flag waver. I'll argue with him again when you're gone, Mr. Hale." "His obstinacy looks very bad," Mr. Hale warned, "especially with you in the army. I've got to report it, of course." Goro shrugged his shoulders. "Have you ever tried to argue with a Japanese papa-san? My pop has some crazy fixed idea, but I'll see what I can do." That Saturday night, the entire Sakagawa family battled out this problem of dual citizenship in Japanese. "I respect your country, Pop," Goro said. "I remember when I had the fight with the priest about going back to Japan. When I finally surrendered, I really intended to go. But you know what's happened, Pop. Football, now the army. Let's face it, Pop, I'm an American." "Me too," Tadao agreed. The sons hammered at him, and finally he said, "I want you to be Americans. When I put a newspaper picture like that over the sink, 4 Sakagawa stars, don't you think I'm proud? Long ago, I admitted you'd never again be Japanese." "Then take our names off the citizenship registry in Japan." "I can't," he repeated for the 50th time. "Damn it, Pop, sometimes you make me mad," Goro cried. Kamajiro stood up. He stared at his sons and said, "There will be no shouting. Remember that you are decent Japanese sons. They came to attention, and he added sorrowfully, "There is a good reason why I cannot change the register." "But why?" the boys insisted. Through the long night the argument lasted, and stubborn Kamajiro was unable to explain why he was powerless to act. For even though his sons were American, he was forever Japanese, and he expected one day to return to Hiroshima. When he got there, he could quietly tell his friends about the mix-up in Hawaii, but he could not do so by letter. He himself could not write, and he could not trust others to write for him. It was 2 o'clock in the morning when he went to bed, and as he pulled the covers up about his shoulders, on a group of aircraft carriers 600 miles away, a task force of Japanese airmen, many of them from Hiroshima, prepared to bomb Pearl Harbor. Shigeo, the youngest of the Sakugawas, rose early next morning and pedaled his bicycle down to Cable Wireless, where he worked on Sundays, delivering cables that had accumulated during the night and those which would come in throughout the day. His first handful he got at 7:30, and they were all addressed to people in the Diamond Head area, like the Hales and the Whipples, who lived in big houses overlooking the city. He had reached Waikiki when he heard from the vicinity of Pearl Harbor a series of dull explosions, and he thought, "More fleet exercises. Wonder what it means." He turned his back on Pearl Harbor and pedaled up an impressive lane leading to the estate of Hawksworth Hale, and while waiting in the porte-cochere he looked back toward the naval base and saw columns of dense black smoke curling up into the morning sunlight. More explosions followed, and he saw a series of planes darting and zigzagging through the bright blue overhead. "Pretty impressive," he thought. He rang the Hale bell again, and in a moment Hawksworth Hale appeared in a dark business suit, wearing collar and tie, as if such a leader of the community were not allowed to relax. Shig noticed that the man's face was colorless and his hands trembling. The radio was making noises from a room Shig could not see, but what it was saying he could not determine. Gulping, in a manner not common to the Hales, Hawksworth pushed open the screen door and said to the star of the Punahou 11, "My God, Shig, your country has declared war on mine." For a moment, Shig could not comprehend what had been said. Pointing back to Pearl Harbor, he asked, "They having a make-believe invasion?" "No," Hawksworth Hale replied in a hollow, terrified voice. "Japan is bombing Honolulu." "Japan?" Shig looked up at the darting planes and saw that where they passed, explosions followed, and that as the planes sped toward the mountains, puffs of gunfire traced them through the sky. "Oh my God," the boy gasped. "What's happened?" Hawksworth held the door open, ignoring the cable, and indicated that Shig should come inside, and they went to the radio, whose announcer was repeating frantically, yet with a voice that tried to avoid the creation of panic, "I repeat, this is not a military exercise. Japanese planes are bombing Honolulu. I repeat, this is not a joke. This is war." Hawksworth Hale covered his face with his hands and muttered, "How awful this is going to be." Looking at bright-eyed Shig, who was only a year older than his own son, he said, "You'll need all the courage you have, son." Shig replied, "Outside you said, your country has declared war on my country. Yours and mine are both the same, Mr. Hale. I'm an American." "I'm sorry, Shig. That's a mistake many of us will make in the next few days. God, look at that explosion." The two watchers winced as an enormous thunder filled the air, accompanied by a slowly rising pillar of jet-black smoke that billowed and twisted upward from the ruins at Pearl Harbor. "Something terrible is taking place," Hale mumbled. Then, from a stairway behind him came a haunted voice, weak and piping like a child's, and he made as if to push Shigeo out the door. But before he could do so, the person on the stairs had come down into the room and stood facing her husband and his visitor. It was Mrs. Hale, a frail and very beautiful woman of 38. She had light auburn hair and wide, level eyes that found difficulty in focusing. She wore a wispy dressing gown such as Shig had never seen before outside the movies, and she walked haltingly. "What is the great noise I hear, Hawksworth?" she asked. "Malama, you shouldn't have come down here," her husband admonished. "But I heard a shooting," she explained softly, "and I wondered if you were in trouble." At this moment, one of the bombing planes was driven off course by a burst of unexpected anti-aircraft fire, and it swerved from its planned escape route, winging swiftly over the Diamond Head area. And as it passed, Shig and Mr. Hale could see on its underbelly the red circle of Japan. "You'd better go now," Mr. Hale said. "You haven't signed for the cable," Shig pointed out. And as Hawksworth took the cable and signed the receipt, his wife walked ghost-like to the door and looked toward Pearl Harbor, where the bombs were still exploding. "Ah," she shrieked in a weird, guttural cry, "it's war, and my son will be killed." Throwing her filmy sleeves over her face, she ran to her husband, sobbing, "It's war, and Bromley will not come back alive." Hale, holding his wife in his right arm, returned the receipt with his left hand and gripped Shigeo by the shoulder. "You must not speak of this," he said. "I won't," Shigeo promised, not understanding exactly what it was that he was expected to keep secret. Kamajiro had risen at 6 that morning and had gone down to the barber shop to sterilize everything again, for part of the success of his shop stemmed from his mania for cleanliness. Now he was back home waiting for his breakfast. His wife Yuriko, who never did her customers' laundry on Sunday, was leisurely preparing a meal, having already fed Shigeo. Goro, enjoying his pass, was sleeping late, but Tadao, who was in the ROTC at the university, had already risen. Ryuko-chan was dressed and ready to go to an early service at the community church in Moili'iri. Minoru, 19 and already in training for basketball at Punahou, was also sleeping. The first to comprehend what was happening was Goro, for when the bomb struck, he thundered out of bed, ran in his shorts into the yard, and shouted, "This is no game. Somebody's declared war." He ran to the radio he had built for the family and heard official confirmation of his suspicions. "Enemy planes of unknown origin are bombing Pearl Harbor and Hickam Field." Turning